There was a party on March 29th, 2001, about a half a block off of Northeast Alberta Street in Portland, Oregon.
There was a dance party in effect. People were dancing, having a good time.
People were drinking, people were dancing, there was all types of 80s music playing. It was loud, you know.
It was loud, I mean, we had loud music and people were outside too, you know. But, yeah, some neighbor called in a noise complaint. It was about 1:30 when the cops came.
It's a non-smoking house, so I would frequent the porch. Last time I did so, I'd been sitting next to a friend of mine, and we'd been talking for a little while, and she was getting ready to go to the store, and, but before she could get up, three officers approach.
One of the cops was really threatening to someone sitting on the porch, to the point that he had his hand on his gun and asked if he was going to have to shoot somebody, and things of that nature. And
I was sitting outside, drinking a beer. The police showed up, three officers. One came up on the porch, and he pretty much had a bad attitude. He was acting very unprofessional. He wanted to see my hands, and I felt uncomfortable, and I started to go inside when he started giving someone else a bunch of crap, and next thing I know, I was on my face. I was hit from behind.
Wow. Scary sounds, and I look back and everything is just kind of, there's a melee of people on the porch. And I didn't know what had happened at that point. I walked up on the porch and was trying to get an eye, and my blood was rushing and scared and pretty paralyzed. I mean, I couldn't see Michael Ray, but I saw his foot, you know, at the bottom of this pile, and there's Sergeant Fort. And the crowd moves towards me, and I'm kind of in the southeast corner of the porch, and this crowd is going towards me, and he looks directly at me, and I'm looking at him, and he kind of he's crouched a little bit, and in his attempt to get up, he lunges towards me, and I have a reflex, and I strike at his body one time, and after doing so, I jump off the banister.
People were confused, and I, you know, perked up my ears. I was like, "What? What's going on?" And I heard the scuffle on the porch going on, and at that point, the door flung open, and I had run to the threshold of the porch, between the porch and the living room, to see what was going on, because I had heard violence.
Chad was inside with me the whole time, because I heard him next to me, and then I guess that's when everything just went downhill. At that point, the cops opened the door, people came in, including Mike, and the door shut again, and then the cops came back in. They have flashlights and mace drawn, and everybody out. And so we all start going out, and there's people with pepper spray in their face coming in, and the cops are trying to get everyone out, and it's like pepper spray wafting in the house. And I'm still confused as to what had happened, because I didn't hear what was going on.
Officer Reynaga had opened up a can of pepper spray right on my face, and I dropped to the ground. Got up, pepper sprayed again, back on the ground, and then had got up and tried to leave the living room to go onto the porch to walk away, and I was detained by about three officers who dragged me down the steps and placed me on the ground.
And then we got outside, and they made us sit down. They were pushing and kicking people down the hill. There's a small hill going from the porch to the sidewalk. They had rifles. I'm assuming they're beanbag rifles, but they had rifles that they're pointing at people's heads and just being really threatening. And I heard Matt ask for someone to get a pen so we could write down numbers, batch numbers, and maybe three or four cops grab Matt by his hair and drag him down the sidewalk. By this time, there's like 50 cop cars and at least 50 cops. There's dogs. There's people in all black suits, like SWAT team looking guys. There's like people in the house. I can see flashlights going through every window.
But, you know, lights are shining everywhere and people are running. And I move through the house on the south and their house and jump over a couple fences until I end up in the yard of the house west of them. People are running kind of headless chickens, and that's exactly what I ended up being, because I ended up back in 12th Street yard. I didn't see this because I was face down, but supposedly there was, you know, guns drawn towards my head while I'm laying down there. I was then brought back to three different cars, scared for my life, yelling to everyone who would listen to watch what's happening to me, and just kind of making my presence known.
And then I saw Bjorn come back from the backyard, and he was limping, and he's just like, everybody look at me, pay attention, my name is Bjorn, like blah blah blah. And they took him off, and I don't know, by this time there's like 5 or 10 different people that are gone.
There's probably about 30 of us on the ground. Lots of us have been pepper sprayed. Lots of us were crying, yelling, speaking very out loud, our discontent with the situation, you know. I know that through my vision, which I started to gain back gradually, I could see the officers taking partygoers out of the house and literally throwing them off the steps, dragging kids by their dreadlocks down the steps, pepper spraying people, violently detaining people and slamming them to the ground. While this was going on, as we sat in our row on the sidewalk, there was officers walking up and down our rows yelling, if you don't shut up, we'll kill you. If you don't, all sorts of things like that.
Chad got dragged off, I think, because he was making a big deal about the pepper spray hurting his eyes and he couldn't find his glasses.
I was yelling, you are the Portland Joint Terrorism Task Force. I know what you're doing. This is crazy. I was yelling, stop hurting my friends. To which the response to me was, you know, the police officer yelling to another police officer, get him out of here. And open up a whole can of mace on him if you have to.
They took photographs of everyone who was at the party, and if you didn't cooperate, they just grabbed you and propped your head up, and the photographs were taken. They photographed tattoos, documented people's names, hauled a few people down to the station.
After that, they took us to an abandoned lot across the street, across Alberta Street, and the sergeant started yelling, you know, I don't want any vandalism. I know you guys, blah, blah, blah. Like, we know who you are, this kind of stuff. And then he's like, you're going to go off 3x3. And that's when we got to leave, finally, hours later, after everyone's already arrested and in jail. And they led us off 3x3 in different directions, told us that the I forget how many block radius, I think a 5-block radius was a emergency zone. And if we were caught walking in it, we would be instantly arrested. And he kind of threatened us if we tried to escape. And then I went home, and that was at 4 a.m. or so.
I think we sit there for about 2 hours. It's hard to say. We're taken to the Northeast Precinct. So I happen to end up in a cell with Chad Hapshie.
They threw me in a holding cell with Bjorn, who was sitting on the ground with his hands behind his back. We started talking for a little bit.
Yeah, there's no urinal in there.
I remember Bjorn having to use the bathroom. They denied him the right to use the bathroom. He said, well, I have to use the bathroom. They denied him again, so he urinated on the floor. At that point, knowing that he, like, the police had, like, looked through the little slot in the doorway, came in and just went house on him.
Five cops show up inside the room and decide I need to be hogtied, but in doing so, they need to make sure that I won't be making any moves anytime soon.
Put him down on the ground, kicked him, punched him, hogtied him, pepper sprayed him. At that point, I had taken my cuffs. I had the cuffs in the back of my hands were in the back of my, in the back, and I took them and I kind of underneath my legs and brought my hands out to the front. I was grabbed by a couple officers. They slammed me down to the ground, put my hands back behind my back and tightened the cuffs to the point where they were cutting off circulation, and I could not get my hands back in front of me again. They left Bjorn basically there in a puddle of his own urine, pepper sprayed with his pants halfway down, hogtied. And I was trying to pull up his pants from behind, because my hands were behind my back, so trying to pull his pants up. I couldn't do it, and he was crying, and I started to cry, and that's when the cop, one officer came in, dragged me out, and put me in a different holding cell.
Well, I was moved to cell with another guy and sat there for a couple hours and watched people get released and just kind of wondering where I was at with everything. Was then maybe 6 o'clock in the morning, 5, 6 o'clock in the morning, interviewed by Sergeant Fort himself. Really, and it's like, well, if I would have got my hands on you, I would have beat you like a motherfucking stepson. I was told that I was an opportunist and that it was a game to me of us versus the cops. And he was like, you saw your chance to get some licks in on a cop, and you took it, and you know, it made you feel pretty good, didn't it? So that was kind of his whole approach to it. Like, it was fun, and you know, like, it's a game to them, and so that's how they perceive other people, I suppose, playing it or living their lives. Because you know, when we were taken into the custody Northeast Precinct, people were high-fiving each other and being like, woo! Oh yeah, like, just screaming and, like, just being, like, rowdy jocks. You know? It reminded me of high school.
When I was in that different holding cell, I believe it was the holding cell right next to Bjorn's, I heard lots of screaming coming from another holding cell where a woman who had been charged with a few offenses as well. She was screaming. I guess she had a really horrible reaction to the pepper spray. And I remember hearing her scream, so I started screaming. I could hear Bjorn screaming, and like in unison, all three holding or four holding cells or how many holding cells were there, everyone just started screaming really loud. It was horrible. It was so horrible. You know, what are they doing in the next cell? Are they beating up this woman? Are they beating up Bjorn? Are they going to beat me up next? You know, what's going to happen to me? It was really, it wasn't the funnest time in my life. I sat in the holding cell for a little while, and then they brought in Matt Kramer, and then they brought in Mike. We were all in there for a little while. Things quieted down at the precinct. About an hour went by. They took Matt out. I believe they processed him and let him go. A couple hours went by. They took Mike out, processed him, and I believe they put him in another holding cell. And then I waited there for a while. At this point, I had no idea what was going on. I had no clue. I was sitting in a big, cold, cement holding cell by myself for hours until about 6:30 in the morning or something like that. We had got brought down to the precinct at like 2. About 6:30, 7 in the morning, police came, grabbed me, you know, said, are you coming downtown with us? Got Mike, threw us in the back of a squad car with our property, brought us to downtown to the Justice Center.
When they took us downtown, they were the deputies at the jail were very rude to us and treated me like I was a joke, like some caged animal. They all would come in and take looks at me and because of my tattoos or whatever.
Basically, from there, we were just processed, put in holding cells for the next few hours, different holding cells. Then they put us all in one big holding cell together, gave us lunch, processed us more, put us in a different cell. We met with I don't know the exact name, but they're the officers that screen you to see if you're like well enough, if you're stable enough to be let out on your own recognizance. Me, Bjorn, and Mike were screened. They let us out. I think I was the first one out. And then Bjorn and Mike.
Well, when I got home that morning, I don't think I went to sleep until like 7 because I was calling different houses to try and see who was missing, because we weren't sure who got arrested, calling the jail, calling the police station. And of course, they were very uncooperative, kind of located everyone, and then I went to sleep. And the next day, I woke up a couple hours later, and it was just immediately starting to get organized, I guess.
The next night, they hauled somebody in and coerced false testimony out of him, put the neighborhood under surveillance. It was all definitely suspicious, to say the least. But, they said to, like, landlords and... I'm not sure if they said it to lawyers or not, but, like, to our landlord, they said that it was a gathering of troublemakers who were going to cause problems on May Day, and that we were having, like, an after-meeting party or something. The neighbors two doors down asked how so many cops got here so quick, and they said, well, this is the Joint Terrorism Task Force at work.
We called Cop Watch and kind of started trying to get people to document what had happened, write it down as soon as possible. And I didn't really start feeling the increased police presence for the next, like, 2 or 3 days. It was after that meeting at this house that I started really noticing that they were around more, and we started hearing stories of people getting stopped and searched and just asked once again about their political beliefs.
Initially, I was like floored by how relaxed the city seemed and how friendly and how liberal. But then you stick around longer and you find out it's not really liberal. There's just a lot of liberal people that moved here, and almost every group of them has had to deal with fighting for their rights, Carrie, who owns Shea What, her girlfriend Jessie was saying, like, she was talking about a lot of the harassment of the lesbian community in, like, the early 70s and stuff when she moved here, and they had it way worse than we ever would. And she felt that we did need to organize and we did need to, show that we had something going on where we weren't just some scattered group of people that they could just pick off as they selected to.
Monday was the arraignment. Before me and Mike had went up in front of the judge, they gave us the option to go out into the hall to the court, one of the court clerks, to sign up for a public defender. We went to the office clerk and they gave us a clipboard with our names and our charges. Under our names where the charges were, we noticed that they had 3 charges just like the initial ones. Only assault on a police officer was dropped, and kidnapping in the first degree was in its place.
We both were just shocked. We were just, we couldn't believe it.
So we were like, Wait, is this some sort of? I think they have us, you know, screwed up with something, you know, somebody else. You know, this is, you know, we were so confused. So we went up to the office clerk and was like, "Excuse me, but this isn't our charge." And she says, "Yes, it is. Yeah, though they switched. Yeah, they switched them."
When I saw they had tacked on the kidnapping charge, that's when I knew that they were really, that they had actually sat down and decided that, you know, this is what we're gonna do to these people.
The first person they called up on the docket was Bjorn. And when Bjorn went up to the stand to hear his charges, the judge did not read the charges, but said something to the effect of, "You are being charged here in this court, effective measure 11. So right there, you know, and they automatically placed the cuffs on him. Me and Mike, we went up and we, one after another, had the cuffs placed on us, and we were sent off.
After the arraignment, they actually ended up stealing my keys and my wallet. I remember, I don't remember what his name was, but he might have been someone of some importance, like with gang activity in the jails. He had my wallet, and he said that I can organize 100 people to come to my arraignment, but I can't show up with $20 in my wallet. And that was the last time I saw my keys in my wallet. And that was the only ill treatment I received.
It was really scary being back in jail, because Measure 11 charges are scary charges. Not only because they're mandatory minimum sentencing, but the bail on Measure 11s are usually, like, ludicrously high. Ours was $260,000. So when we were, you know, we processed again, put in holding cells for 2 days. At least I was. I had no contact with Bjorn or Mike.
I was only in for, say, 4 to 5 days. At that point, there wasn't a whole lot of support. A few people tried to get messages to me, and I think I got one. But other than that, I just waited. I'm just upset that, you know, these police officers would do something like that to another human being, that they felt that it was okay to let someone sit in jail, having not done anything and being charged with a serious Measure 11 crime.
It was really scary. I had so many thoughts in my head, like, I'm never gonna leave this place. I'm going to jail for years. No one can afford that bail. I'm gonna be in here until my trial comes. You know, how's my partner? Is she freaking out? How are my friends feeling? Do my parents know? Like, it was really scary. Like, I actually try not to think about it, but it's just because I didn't know. I didn't know what was gonna happen to me. You know, my life was in the state's hands at this point. And knowing how the state works, I figured I was doomed. I was in such a state of melancholy. I could not think positive. I could not act positively. All I could do was anything to make me forget where I was. So I wrote a lot. I tried to, like, read as many books as possible. When I had my 2 hours out on the TF floor, I made lots of phone calls. And, of course, there was meal times, which the schedule of meal, I mean, it sort of broke up the monotony of sitting in a cell, only because you got to go out of your cell, walk down the steps, get your tray, go back to your room, close the door, and eat your food, go back down, drop the tray off, go back up, and sit in your cell for another, like, 4 hours. They had classified me 8th module, which was reserved for security threats, gang members, and crazies. That's what the CEOs called them. A man from the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, who I would presume is an FBI agent as well, had taken me into a separate room, out of my holding cell, into a separate room, polaroided all of my tattoos, and asked me if I had any affiliation with the Earth and Animal Liberation Front, asked me if my tattoos were of an anarchist nature, asked me if I was an anarchist, asked me what I think of the Animal and Earth Liberation Front. All these questions, I was basically, no, you know. So that's how I figured out, you know, they had classified me as an anarchist, which in their eyes is the equivalent of a gang member. On my second day in jail, I had an interview with Cold Street Supervision Program. What they do is they interview prisoners to basically recognize if they're capable enough and stable enough to be outside of jail, because they can't afford bail. The name says it all, closed street supervision, you know. What they do is they knock down your bail as well. My bail was $260,000. They were going to knock down to $5,000. They came, they saw me. It was almost right away. Sometimes you have to wait 5-6 days. They saw me on the second day. So I got a little bit more positive. It was still difficult. But as the days went by, I made some friends. I started doing a lot of exercises, breathing exercises, lots of push-ups, sit-ups, running in place. Running in place in a 8x8 cell is not the most easiest thing to do, but I did it. And it helped, you know. And I started to read more. They actually had some okay books. They had Brave New World. They had that book. And I started working towards my release a lot. I started being able to sleep at night. And then one day, a few comrades showed up and said, "You're getting bailed out, full bail." And I flipped out, of course, naturally. And within a few days, the bail money was put into my account, in which I bailed myself out. So it started off really, really dismal. But eventually, you know, it worked out and I became more positive and I was released.
I got a good lawyer. And he, within a week, I did easily prove that I didn't do anything. He sent out investigators. I went to a private polygrapher, and all the results and all the testimonies were sent to the DA. And the whole thing was just a shock to me, and it was just a stressful experience. As far as the community is concerned, I don't think I've ever felt so supported in my life. It's, you know, everyone was, you know, there for us, and you know, every person I saw, you know, had something to say to try to cheer me up.
When this all happened, people were there, like, it spread like wildfire. Like, I got letters from Philly and New York, and people knew about it in Norway and Florida, and everyone I knew and their friends showed up to support me and Chad. Everyone did what they could. I got notes every day. Like, I'd wake up with this stack of pink slips underneath my door at like 5:30 or 6 a.m.
There's these things, these pink slips, they're memo notes that people can write from the outside at the main office in the Justice Center, and they, you know, bring them up to you right in the morning. And every morning I had at least like 6 memo notes, you know. I actually still have them in my closet, but it's a whole stack of just, you know, "We love you, we support you, this is crap, you know, we're gonna work to get you free, you know, keep your head up, you know."
It just filled me up. I'm like, it made me so much stronger, and I'm like, I can do this, fuck these people, like, it's my friends, they know where I am, and I didn't feel so lost and so confused anymore. I'm like, these people are there with me, and, you know, on every level, like, everything, like, when I was in there, you know, like, I have a puppy. you know, someone figured out where to take her and like who could take care of her, and just made arrangements immediately. There was food delivered to my roommates, my house, where there was a lot of stress and a lot of confusion, and just to kind of ease things. And there was just this continual like network of support, you know, like, and it wasn't something new. That's the thing. It had always kind of been there, and like it just kind of came together very strongly at one point. Like it was all very concentrated around this one thing. But this is the community that I live in and that I'm proud of and that I couldn't live without.
People that weren't at the party were interested in knowing what went on, how to help, and they kind of organized a second meeting. And that was like when the general organizing started, where a lot of people that weren't at the party started participating in security trainings and legal trainings, cop watch trainings, and kind of liaise with media and other groups that were working around police brutality issues.
From that large meeting, a few different smaller working groups came about. One which was media, one which was fundraising, one which was community defense, and a few others that I don't quite remember. And from my personal interest, I got involved in the community defense aspect of it because I feel that the police will continue and have continued to really interrogate and follow and do tactics that are really repressive to our community and to activists. Not only the situation at the party, but the situation that was ongoing and continued to get worse throughout the summer.
Some neighbors of 12th Street said when they asked the officers to identify themselves, they identified themselves as the Joint Terrorism Task Force. At the arraignment, they walked up and were kind of standing there plain clothes, and we knew that they were cops because Cop Watch was there and had dealings with those particular cops before. We got their cards. They tried to give an off-duty ticket, and we documented them, and their cards said gang enforcement. So we knew that some sort of task force was definitely on our trail, and people started investigating. The legal team did quite a bit of investigating, getting out information on that and similar task force across the country, which are in place in a lot of other cities aside from Portland.
My initial idea was we formed what was called the Incident Response Team, and there were about 9 or 10 working members of the Incident Response Team, and the goal of it was to get as much information as possible to show that the cops are repressing us in these ways. And what I had done was I had taken a piece of paper that was modeled after data collection for the NAACP in terms of racial profiling. Every member of the incident response team had a to-go bag, and what the to-go bag had in it was documentation materials, which would include like a camera, notepad, pens, that incident response team flyer, which encompassed the names of the people involved, how many cops were present, and the name of the cops, their badge numbers, and then kind of a summarization of the event that happened. So it was kind of like a cop watch, a smaller cop watch for North Portland, Northeast Portland specifically. My long-term personal goal was to have that compiled so we could file a civil suit against the cops. That kind of information was to be gathered through those pieces of paper to hopefully, you know, have a solid of enough case to do that.
The legal committee, I think, had high hopes at the beginning, and in the end ended up doing more researching and putting together information, which I felt was really necessary. But in the beginning, it was like, oh, we're going to get a lawyer, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, and that really wasn't going to happen.
We also were really concerned that, you know, people were not trusting one another and were just feeling really scared all the time, which are really, really valid concerns. You know, people were being pulled over on their bikes all the time for not having the right lights on their bikes. And so we just wanted to provide a number that people could call if they saw one of their friends or somebody being pulled over, so the incident response team could go and number one, cop watch, do some sort of cop watching and data collection, and also show that people in the community care. So we were there not only as like data collectors, but we were also there as emotional support for people. And you know, the scene is really big and it encompasses a whole bunch of different types of people. And it was kind of our attempt to bridge the gaps between our sub-communities and our larger community.
I was really interested in being a major part of those meetings to guard against anyone's agenda, because it was even brought up straight up at a meeting. Someone was like, this is an effective tool for organizing. And Matt stood up and was like, these are people. These are our friends. They're not tools for organizing.
We kind of banded together a bit to protect ourselves from the activists as well, who, you know, feel that if this was made very political, that maybe we could, you know, strike a blow at the cops. It might help for a civilian review board. Maybe it'd get the case thrown out. But our personal feeling was that it would not, that it would intensify things. And the defendants in the case, like the three people who ended up getting tried, felt that way. And at least two of them felt that way very strongly.
It was just very frustrating. I didn't know what I could do to help them. Not to mention that my lawyer, basically anything I said to anyone had to go through him. That was frustrating. I feel that if it was made aware to the community that maybe, you know, maybe they wouldn't be in a forest camp right now. But also the way they were treating the case, just, you know, there's a good chance that all three of us would be in jail right now.
That was hard. It's like, yeah, there's some fucked up shit going on here, and people need to know. But I think there's intelligent ways of going about it, and I'm not willing to sacrifice the rest of my life for a banter and a slogan. I can't do that, and it's not me, you know, and I never intended to, you know, and some people want to run with it, and, you know, I can understand that, you know, if they don't know me, and that's their passion, is to kind of uncover the injustice, whatever the cost.
People started getting scared to leave their house within that first week because of the police presence. The two houses on 17th Street, they were getting spotlighted. They were having cops drive by at least 20 times a day. There were cops sitting outside of their house sometimes. They were getting stopped when they would come in late at night. One woman that was staying there left her job and had a cop follow her all the way home and then give her a ticket in the driveway and asked to go inside. And just people started being afraid to open the door and getting really paranoid, maybe in a healthy way, maybe in a not so healthy way. And I mean, it was all a catalyst for all the organizing that went on, so it did have some positive outcome, I suppose.
It's kind of like, I think, how you change your behavior when you move to a neighborhood that's higher crime. You know, you're more aware, you're kind of looking over your shoulder, you know, you're just looking out for yourself. And that's kind of what I did, because Northeast kind of became a bad neighborhood to me, but not because of the people, but because of the cops. And mm-hmm. I always felt like I had to kind of be on the lookout.
On numerous times they've followed me walking down the street, riding my bike down the street. There's been several times where I've been walking down Alberta and a police officer will drive by, pull over, wait for me to walk by, drive another block, wait for me to walk by, and continue that. I'd carried a knife since I was a little kid, from the time I was probably like 5 or 6. But now I don't, for fear of, you know, meeting an officer like Officer Fort on a dark street some night and him shooting me. because, you know, if they can make up a story like they did that night, you know, all he would have to say is that I went for a weapon. It's a common story in this neighborhood. It's happened more than once.
I did not ever get stopped. I talked to a lot of police officers. I got pretty good at asking the numbers, and they would try to kind of evade your question. And I didn't feel quite as frightened as some of my friends did. I just got this attitude early on that if they want to stop me, they can stop me, and I'm ready for them. I carried a notebook around everywhere I went. Even riding my bike, I had it out so that I didn't even have to reach in my pocket if I got stopped.
With my appearance, you know, it's pretty obvious who I am. I'm not incognito. To feel safer, I do try to travel with somebody. I try to just do simple things to keep myself from having encounters with the police, like having bike lights. And a lot of times I'll wear like a bright yellow jacket instead of, you know, like over like a black sweatshirt and a hat, which gives a little bit of feeling of security.
Cops freak me out more now. Not freak me out in the sense that I get scared, but they keep me on my toes. They keep me always looking over my shoulder in some sort of like expectation that at any moment I, you know, that they may pull me over. I mean, I'm not terrified. If they want to get me, they're gonna get me. I'm definitely on my toes, you know.
Summer came and more people were coming into town. People were leaving as well. All the people who were involved, you know, had plans on their, you know, for their own lives.
I was bitter about Portland when I left, you know, like bitter. And going to other places, I did feel freer, you know. The cops drove by and I knew they were just driving by. And that was kind of when I actually thought more about the connection of race and the police and how the oblivion that a lot of us live under is so race privileged that it's kind of sickening.
The direness of the whole situation kind of lost momentum, and we started to have less meetings. And Portland is a center of constant rotation of people living here. And so to have the energy to educate people of the history of what just happened in Portland, you know, this incident and this police repression, people come here and to be terrified of the cops and literally terrified to ride their bikes at night, but not really understand, you know, all the things that are going on that people are trying to do to make that fear lessened. And no one really having the energy to organize, like monthly meetings to say, okay, these are the things that happen in Portland. These are the things that you could be detained for. These are the things that actually have happened in the last 6 months. And these are the things you can do. And these are the things that are here for you. And this is what we've built. And that was a huge gap.
People started getting burnout on meetings, on trainings, on pamphlets and leaflets. And in that way, it kind of was a little less effective than it was intended.
When you're at such an intense level, continuously, and working on this issue over and over and over again, and it's just like consuming your life, you definitely reach a burnout point. And it's not that police presence diminished. By maybe the end of the summer, the incident response team was pretty much gone, and the cell phone was pretty much disbanded.
I lucked out. I had like a super cool judge who kind of, she knew, Judge Frankel, what was going on here, and saw through it all and was just like, you know, trying to make this as easy as it could be on us with certain limitations. Like, she couldn't reduce the sentence any after that. And she's like, you know, are you going to be okay with this? And, you know, like, if you want some time off in the middle of this, like, if you have a week or two that you want to, and The forest camp coordinator found it unheard of. Like, he was like, "You what? You got a week off? This is not real." If everyone thought like I was thinking that I've won by not participating in this mess of fucking horrible system and all that, like, I'd be fucked right now. It was really hard for me to accept any lawyer and trust anything and not be overly suspicious, or I wouldn't say overly, I think it's called for, but it was hard for me to give any kind of trust to this guy. And but it actually didn't take long, because there was some money pulled together where I had the opportunity to interview some private attorneys, and they didn't hold up. Like, they were about the money, and you could tell, and they just emanated. And this guy, he has a true love for what he's doing. He just, you know, couldn't bear witness to kind of the injustice that's happening. So his eyes are even open wider, you know, like, since this all happened. But, you know, on the day that I signed the papers, he had to leave the room. He was like, had tears in his eyes. He was like more emotional than I was, you know. It's like, there's people out there who care, and that you wouldn't have thought. And I think the judge was one of them. That weekend, I was kind of tossing and turning, and like, just like, did I make the right decision? What did I do? It was really hard.
If they had gone to trial, you know, they were going to try and play the whole eco-terrorist card, and
September 11th, that's the day that my trial with the jury was going to initiate.
The plane crashes in the World Trade Center and everyone's out for blood. They would have been nailed for something that never happened.
It's not that this repression has ceased. I mean, I myself am terrified of our friends getting arrested again and our friends going to jail again. And I've been spending a lot of time with people who have dealt with these issues for a while now, and just hearing how their worlds are never the same, and their inability to trust anybody is continual now. And I don't want to get to that point. I don't want to get to the point where we fear that every single person is here to infiltrate us, and every single person here is to, you know, to break us apart.
One thing that's crossed my mind recently is that the police presence lately has seemed really lax. I don't know, I just question the reason behind that. I don't believe that it's just the police being like, oh, we're not concerned with them anymore. Because it was so heavy for so long that they obviously are concerned with our community. I don't know, I was just thinking that the other day. I guess I wanted to talk to more people about kind of being aware of that and reestablishing some sort of dialogue on security.
I've definitely had ideals that maybe I didn't know how to act on before, and I didn't know how to approach it. But this has given me a new grip on just a little piece of the shit cake. I did not know anything about Measure 11 when I got thrown into this. You know, and I knew the Portland Police Department has a legacy that's hard to ignore. Up till then, you know, what I thought was my politics were to live my life the way I want to do, with causing the minimum harm possible and living as cheaply and having as much time to do the things that make me happy and the people around me. That was pretty much the extent of my politics, and any one of us at any point could really be targeted or caught up in one of their political games. So it's inspired me to be more active and more aware. I'm definitely more inspired to educate myself and try to educate other people about the prisons and the jails. Like, the little bit that I've been able to do since I've been out is just work with books to prisoners. I don't know. I'm never going to be able to shake this, nor would I want to. I mean, this is just, it's impossible for me to ignore the situation that we live in.
There's lots of things I've learned from this. I mean, a lot of things I don't want to get into, but the things that I'm really glad I learned. And it's really crazy to say, but it's things that I feel like maybe I would not have learned if it wasn't for this event.
There were a lot of friends that I consider really close to me now that I hardly knew when this began and just became close with because of going to meetings every day and talking about it every day and trying to be there for each other and cook each other food and take care of each other. And it really caused a lot of connections and made me bonded with people that I hadn't really known before. And it's totally changed the way that we interact with each other, because before it was kind of a, you know, see him around, like hang out, party kind of thing. And then all of a sudden we were working on this big project together, and it definitely tightened bonds within my circle of friends. But I really think that people have more of a confidence in dealing with police, in dealing with all sorts of authority figures and knowing their rights and how the court system works a little more. I mean, it was kind of a crash course for the legal system for me because I was pretty involved in the legal group and still am, actually. I mean, it is still going on. That's something that I think is really positive. Like, it's still a resource there if need be.
I ran to the porch that night because I felt like it was my responsibility. You know, as far as I knew, police were attacking people. I don't think there's anything I would do different. When the police come and they intentionally harass people or try to intimidate people, or they're even using downright violence, I feel that I should be there to see this and to do what I can to either stop it or to take the necessary steps to make sure that these police get called on it, whether it's taking badge numbers or taking their pictures or whatever. You know, there's nothing I would do different.
I feel if Officer Ford hadn't been giving me a hard time, he would have been giving someone else a hard time that night. He would have found another reason to pick on somebody. The only thing I really have to say is that it seems like Bjorn and Chad are being held accountable for whatever their alleged actions were, but these police officers are out on our streets and our neighborhoods right now, and they're not being held accountable for the fact that they lied. And it disturbs me. You know, we can't do anything about it.
It would be neat to have another meeting to say, oh, we think this is gone. It's not gone. It's going to come back, and it's going to come back in a harder force than it ever has been, because there's a lot more money for the Portland Joint Terrorism Task Force, and there's a lot more money for just cops in general. And so we as a community, I think, have a good foundation to go from. This is more than likely going to happen again at some point, but we're ready for it in a lot of ways. If we were to have to have another incident response team or another larger working group, we could do it. The foundation has been laid.
This was produced by Aaron Yankee at KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. Interviews were conducted by Mo Baustern and Aaron Yankee. Thanks to Bjorn, Chad, Kim, Matt, Mike, Sarah, and Iggy Scamp.